Hello and welcome to The Price of Music, the show that looks at the money behind the music industry with me, Steve Lamack, and Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge. There's no prizes for this, but can you guess which one of us watched the Brit Awards in its entirety at the weekend and which one of us didn't? How were the Brits, Stuart?
I enjoyed them, you know. I enjoyed them. I love seeing... I think I've reached that stage of life where I enjoy watching it on TV. But we did watch the red carpet show beforehand, and I've also reached that age where people say, and with us today is Phil. And everyone watching knows who Phil is, because he's like an influencer or Radio 1 CJ. And I'm like there going, I need a surname so I can Google this. So yeah, I was feeling my age at points, but yeah, I enjoyed it.
Well, this time next year, young man, I wouldn't be surprised if someone invites you along. They'll all be saying, there's the man from The Price of Music. There he is.
They should have a podcast award, shouldn't they, I think? They should have a podcast award, best music industry-focused money podcast of the year.
Which appears on a Wednesday. Yeah, that's us. We'll come back to the Brits in a second. By the way, if you can hear the noise of some kids behind me, that's because I live next door to a school playground and it's break time. So that's the noise in the background. Anyway, where should we start? Before we do, actually, there was one or two interesting points that came out of the Brits. Before we get to that, though, we should mention this, a massive fine for Apple. The European Commission has fined Apple over $1.8 billion for anti-competitive practices around music streaming services.
Yeah, so it's kind of, this is like a long story, really. I mean, I won't make it long because it's also a regulation story and they're quite boring. But back in 2019, Spotify complained to the European Commission about Apple. And basically would say that Apple was being unfair in terms of letting Spotify, how it uses App Store, how much it charged Spotify for its subscriptions, like saying it was unfairly limiting it in various ways. And so the European Commission launched an investigation, and here we are, what, 5 years on now, and they ruled against Apple. So they said, yeah, Apple has been treating companies like Spotify unfairly, its rules governing what they could do. And it was very much focused on Spotify not being allowed to say in its app for iPhones, oh, you can go and subscribe on our website and it's cheaper there. So they weren't allowed to do that. And that's been ruled illegal. And yeah, there was reports in January saying, yeah, Apple are going to lose this case and they're going to be fined 500 million euros. And everyone was like, wow, that's a big fine. And it turned out to be nearly kind of four times that. So 1.8 billion euros, which for context, Apple makes 1.8 billion euros every couple of days from selling iPhones and iPads and services. So it's not going to bankrupt the company by any stretch, but it's like one of the biggest fines that's ever been seen in Europe.
So they won't be wincing too much in the accounts department. But is this, I don't know, does this feel almost like it's going to bruise their ego? They'd rather have not been made to look like the bad guys in public.
I think so. They're very cross. They put this big statement out basically having a go at Spotify and saying Spotify wants to use our app store and our devices and not pay us any money and have it for free. They called out how many meetings Spotify had with the European Commission during the investigation. It's like a little sort of like, look, they've been meeting with them. It's all about. So, yeah, I mean, it's part of this much bigger picture, which is like the European regulatory folk. They're really kind of cracking down on big tech companies. So Apple, but also Google, Meta, TikTok, they're kind of standing up and saying, you know what, we're going to set quite strict rules for these companies. And if they break them, we're going to punish them. And so Apple is kind of, this case predates all that, but it's kind of, it's almost like they're being, not being made an example of, but they're kind of saying, right, we are not afraid to fine Apple loads of money for this. But Apple's going to appeal this ruling. And they're already in a different fight about a different set of European regulations that Spotify is very cross about the way Apple is approaching things. So I think we're going to see another sort of 3, 4, 5 years of Spotify and Apple fighting in public over this. And if you're the European Commission, you have to kind of referee it and say, well, we think what you're saying is right, or you've done this wrong. Yeah. So it's kind of a big fine, but this is like in the middle of this story rather than the end of it. There's going to be lots more public arguments.
You mentioned Spotify. Well, just while we're on the subject of streaming, it turns out the opportunity has arisen for Stuart here to interview a representative from Spotify, quite a senior member of the Spotify staff, which Stuart will be recording in just under a week's time, I think. And as part of this, obviously, we would love to be able to ask some of the questions that you would like to put to Spotify. Pretty much anything, I think. I mean, any observations you'd like to make? I mean, you might just want to say Spotify has changed my life. It's opened up all sorts of music which I'd never have listened to before. Or you might want to take issue with the way they pay artists or how their algorithms work, or you might have a completely different query. Pretty much anything, I think, that we will try and pass on.
I think so, yeah, because they recently announced their payouts. So I think we're going to be talking about how they pay money out, who it goes to. And yeah, I think when we've done Spotify before, we've had reactions, haven't we? People have got strong opinions, but we'd love questions and we can put them directly to the company.
Excellent. This is your chance. Speak now or forever grumble into the void. Your streaming-based questions or Spotify-related comments, drop us a line, theprice of music podcast@gmail.com, sooner rather than later, please, to avoid disappointment. So back to the Brits. Aside from, I mean, everything else which came out of the Brits and the winners and the losers, Stuart picked up on this. This was an interesting comment, which also chimed with a couple of threads on the socials last week, because the big winner on the night, Ray, used her acceptance speech to call for songwriters to receive master royalty points. Now, what's behind this? And more importantly, what are master royalty points?
Yeah, this was the moment when I had to put down my kind of my can of cider and get back to work, because she suddenly said something on stage that was relevant to my business, my work. But yeah, so she said something like, while I'm here, I think it was a second award or third award she got, you know, while I'm here, British Record Music Industry, I want to have a brief conversation about normalizing giving songwriters master royalty points. And it means if the songs win big, the writers win big too. So yeah, it's about like a share of the recording royalties from tracks. So if you're a songwriter and you write a song and someone records it, you get publishing royalties on that when it's performed, when it's used, but you don't get a share of the actual royalties for the recording itself. But some other people do. Like sometimes producers get a share of that. So if you produce a song, you might get a share of the recording royalties. Sometimes the A&Rs get a couple of points. And when points means like a percentage, isn't it? I think so. What if you get 1 point, you get 1% of the royalties and so on. And there's been this debate, I think, about songwriters, like shouldn't they get a stake in the success of recordings based on their work? And it's been in the news before. So like last year, there's this guy called Justin Tranter, who's like one of the big pop songwriters. Like, you know, he writes for like, you know, global pop artists, and he's got a label. And last year they announced they were going to give 3 points of their recording royalties to the songwriters of tracks. So he's a songwriter himself, and he's saying, right, my label's going to do this. We're going to make sure that whenever we have a recording that gets popular, the songwriters are going to benefit from those royalties too. And so Ray has kind of reignited this debate about, yeah, the song is really important to every recording, every track out there. So perhaps the songwriters, who they receive a much smaller slice of streaming royalty. We talked about this before, I think, like the recording gets a lot more, the publishing, the songwriter gets less. And so this could be a way of kind of rebalancing a bit, giving songwriters a bit more money from streaming. And Ray, of course, like the thing that I didn't really appreciate until recently is, like, she's obviously an artist, but she's written for a bunch of really huge artists. She's written for like Anita. She's written for Little Mix. Like, she's a songwriter for other people too, which she has been. So she's got experience with the thing. I think of people having massive hits with something she wrote, and she's seen the royalty checks that she got from that. So she's kind of speaking from experience. So I think the thing is about this, though, it's not something that can kind of change all at once for everyone. It's not like there'll be a law saying you must give songwriters a share of recording royalties. It's more going to be individual labels and maybe individual artists saying, yeah, I want to do this. And it'll be quite private, I think. Like, people don't generally shout about this, about who gets what. But Ray talking about it on stage at the Brits might encourage some people to say, yeah, actually, this sounds like a good idea. We'll do it. So we might see some labels talk about doing it. We might see some artists say, yeah, I agree with her. I'm guessing we'll see her do it if she's not doing it already, because she's kind of put her flag out there. So, yeah, it could be good news for songwriters, I suppose.
I think, though, if there's one thing we have learned about the music industry over the past few weeks, it's not an industry that loves change. But we'll wait and see.
Well, the other thing here, actually, is if you give points to songwriters on recordings, that slice of royalties is coming off someone else's share. So it could come out of the label's share, or it could come out of the artist's share. So the artist could lose out. So that's one thing to be settled. If you're going to give money to songwriters, the tone of the debate so far has been like, it should come out of the label's share. The artist shouldn't be penalized. But there's kind of a thing of like who wins, who loses. And hopefully it's not going to be recording artists losing out. Hopefully it'll be kind of, you know, figured out.
Next, following Apple's dust up with their competition, that TikTok versus Universal Music Group spat, which we reported on a couple of weeks ago, that's still ongoing, despite the fact that both of us predicted it would all be over within 3 weeks. It's still, in fact, I mean, if anything, it's flared up even more recently. So to update you, for anyone who missed the original story, explain to us what's happened, where this started, and why they still haven't sorted it out.
Yeah, so Universal Music Group, the biggest major label, which also has one of the biggest publishing groups, Universal Music Publishing Group, their license with TikTok for used music was about to expire and they couldn't reach a new deal. And they basically had a massive go at each other in public. Universal said TikTok wanted to pay a ridiculously small amount of money for its music. They kind of accused them of not being a safe place. They accused them of having nefarious plans for artificial intelligence. And TikTok hit back and said Universal was greedy and self-serving and harming its artists. So, like, quite unusually public. When we were talking before, Universal Music Group's recordings have been taken off TikTok. So artists like Taylor Swift, Billie Eilish, their recordings have been removed. You couldn't use them in your videos. But there was, like, an extra month for the publishing. So what's happened now is TikTok is having to remove any recording based on a song written by a songwriter who's signed to Universal Music Publishing Group. And the reason that's kind of an escalation is some of those recordings aren't Universal recordings. So, for example, Harry Styles is signed to Sony Music, a rival label, but as a songwriter, he's signed to Universal. So anything he's written or co-written has to come down now. It's a big mess, really, now, because it's not just one label's music coming down. It's anything that's been in any way written or co-written by anyone signed to Universal's songwriting division. And there's been people we try to work out how much music is that? And there was one report saying it could be as much as like 80% of all the music on TikTok has to come off. TikTok said last week that it's only between 20 and 30% of popular songs on the app are covered by this. So TikTok itself is saying nearly a third of its music is going to have to be the popular music removed. So it's kind of, it's not got worse in terms of the rhetoric. Like when they first fell out, they were quite rude about each other, like really genuinely rude. In the last week, TikTok said, we still want to reach a deal. There was a brilliant thing. Universal had their financial results. And Sir Lucian Grange, the boss of Universal Music Group, he sort of said they can't get a free ride. He was critical still. But then he went something like, we're friendly people. My phone is open, unfortunately, 24 hours a day. So, it unwittingly sounds slightly mafia, like we're friendly people. But what he was saying there was, we are open to sorting this out. And I think that was like a little, not a climb down, but like a little olive, not an olive branch, maybe an olive twig, you know. They're sort of saying they both want to reach a deal. But yeah, at the moment, it's very hard. If you're a TikTok user, it's very hard to know what you can't use until you see it's not there. Go to search for it. So yeah, there's a whole bunch of music removed.
And as we were saying, the longer this goes on, and it is affecting some new releases, which had a marketing budget for TikTok, or the marketing plan was based around the sort of advertising, the sort of promo that you can do with TikTok. So there's a lot of records out there probably still on the blocks or are coming out without the support that they would have otherwise had. So it is a bit of a spanner in the works still, though.
And it's definitely, it's a big headache as well, because the thing about publishing rights is, so if you're TikTok and you've got to remove all Universal Music's recordings, you can kind of scan. So if someone upload, you can remove them from your catalog, you can scan for them. But when it comes to publishing, you're talking about cover versions, So, for example, like, and this is my business idea for this podcast. If we were to set up a TikTok channel of us doing our Taylor Swift acoustic covers, which is what the world has been waiting for, I'm sure. Like, that's not allowed, but someone has got to detect that me caterwauling into a microphone is singing a Taylor Swift song or is singing a Harry Styles composition.
Mm.
So suddenly as a headache, Universal Music has got to kind of detect cover versions of all its publishing works. TikTok's got to take them down. So there's kind of a big mess now. It's kind of extended not just beyond the actual recorders, it's extended to, you know, anyone on TikTok with a guitar doing a cover could now find themselves, their music being removed, and could get TikTok in hot water. Because if it doesn't take that stuff down, Universal will be sending lawyers after it.
Wow.
So we maybe shouldn't do that channel after all. I think we should avoid that for the moment, but maybe next year.
I mean, much to everyone's disappointment, we might have to put that on hold for a little while. We'll come back to it. We'll revisit that. In other news this week, the UK government has ruled out broadcast-style equitable remuneration for the music industry, which begs the question, what is equitable remuneration? Who's campaigning for this? And why has their campaign fallen on deaf ears?
Yeah, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to call it ER from the start. Because equitable remuneration is one of the hardest phrases I find to say. So it's something we already have here for radio and for TV. Like if you get your song played on the radio, money gets collected for that performance and it gets shared between artists and their labels. So instead of paying it all to the label who then share it with the artist, for radio plays, some of it gets paid directly to the artist and they get a bigger share. I think it might be 50%. I'm not entirely sure the exact total, but as an artist, you get a bigger share of radio plays than you do of streams of music. And so for a while now, and this was really something that Tom Gray, who we mention a lot, I think, with his Broken Record campaign here in the UK, he had this argument that was, look, streaming is kind of, in some ways, like radio. Like if you are listening to a playlist or if you're letting the algorithm play you stuff, you're kind of leaning back in your chair and listening and someone or something is playing you music like the radio. And so his argument was, well, if it sounds like radio and seems like radio, maybe it should be treated like radio and apply ER to it so that artists would get 50% of the royalties for those streams. And this was a big part of his argument. It was discussed in Parliament. It was recommended in a report. And labels didn't like it. And by that, I mean independent labels and major labels alike. They were worried by it and they argued that it would reduce their ability to invest in new music. It would weaken their negotiating clout with streaming services. And they were kind of like, they were saying, we're not being selfish. We're not trying to keep all the money. It would actually affect what we can do in these ways. And that was the argument, you know, ER is fairer to artists versus labels saying, but it would harm what we can do. And that would be harmful in the long term. So the government kind of looked into it and they commissioned this report from the Intellectual Property Office saying, well, what is it? You know, should it work? Should we do it? And this report is marvelous because it kind of says, basically, yeah, there are some worries around this and we don't really know what the effects would be. And there are some risks. And like a lot of reports, it said, we need more research into this. Like it was very careful in its conclusions. It didn't say, this is terrible, this is brilliant. It said, we need more research. There was some, it could be risky, but this report came out. And then the government that same day said, yeah, no, we're not doing ER then. That sounds like a bad idea. And the government essentially ruled it out. So it's not going to happen. Well, it's not going to happen in the UK as things stand, but who knows? There could be a general election in May. There could be a general election in November. Could be a new government in. And where the fun twist in that is that Tom Gray himself is standing to be an MP for Labour in the next election. So there's like this scenario where in like 6 months' time, a year's time, the idea of ER could be resurrected, but this time with Tom Gray in Parliament, if he gets voted in, with a position to kind of try and make it happen. So it's one of those things where it's been ruled out for the moment as a new way of treating streaming royalties, but it could well reappear in the future.
I was thinking, actually, we should do something about needle time, shouldn't we, at some point, which is how much, if you don't have needle time, it's basically how much artists get paid for being played on the radio. We'll do that. If I can get my hands on the current figures, it's quite hard, I think, tracking down the precise figures, but I think the last time I looked, and there's quite a bit of cash in it for musicians if you played on the radio. The last time I looked, I mean, these are really old figures, but I think Radio One, the payout from Radio One was about £13 a minute, I think, and Six Music was something like £5 a minute. I mean, you have to be signed up to a collection agency like PRS or PPL who collect the money for you. But we'll get into that. If anyone's interested, drop us a line. Next time, well, this is an interesting one. As the live music industry looks to address its carbon footprint, the 1975 have just played the world's first carbon removed arena events at the O2 in London, and I know there are various, even the trade body Live, which I'm the chair of, we have a green committee looking at how we can get to net zero in, I think the deadline is something like 6 years now, but this obviously was quite a profile start from a band who are, you know, well, massive. They did about four shows at the O2, I think, didn't they?
They did, yeah. And they've been one of the bands who've talked about the climate emergency before, and they've talked about how they're trying to make their merchandise more sustainable and all the stuff. So they've got a track record of trying to do stuff around this area. But yeah, it was a really interesting pilot project. So I think it was about, and I've had to go and do a lot of Googling about what residual carbon emissions are and so on, but it was about predicting the emissions of the concerts in terms of like the catering, the travel of the band, but also of the fans, electricity. And I think they worked out it was about more than 100 tons of residual carbon emissions, which are the ones you can't reduce any further. Like that's, you know, that's how much kind of carbon you're emitting. And they worked with this company called, and it's written CUR8, and I assume that's Curate, but I could be wrong, who connect people with projects that physically extract carbon out of the atmosphere. So it's things like planting trees and helping soil better hold carbon. And so if you are a promoter or a venue, you could say, right, 100 tons of carbon from the show. So we will spend money on projects that will take that much carbon out of the atmosphere to try and balance it all up. And yeah, so for the 975 gigs, I think they calculated all this stuff and then the promoter paid for some of it. And they also calculated how much the audience would amount to in terms of their emissions when they're traveling to and from the venue. And I think they had like 90p to a ticket for it. So kind of fans paid for a bit of it and the promoter paid for a bit of it. And yeah, it's kind of one of the first, and it's very much, I think it's a pilot. So they're going to publish a report later this month, like explaining how they did it and what the effects were and how it worked. And the idea is that to show other people they can do it too, you know, so it's not just a one-off. It's like a, how can we make this more common in all kinds of venues, all kinds of bands.
I'd be really interested to see the costs involved. And obviously that, as you say, that will go on the ticket price. But how much? Because I imagine it must cost a fair whack. But then again, O2 holds a lot of people. So, you know, a little bit on every ticket, maybe that, you know, adds up to being able to do this on a more regular basis. I do know one. Here's one thing about the O2, which I bet you don't know, which is there's a Wormery at the O2.
No, got it. Yeah, really?
Yeah. Someone I know was given a guided tour recently. I mean, I think probably in conjunction with this one of the 1975 gigs, and it was being showed around. Yeah, and they've got a Wormery to help deal with the venue's food waste. And on the day he was there, they were waiting for a delivery of 20,000 worms. Back them in.
That's a big Wormery.
Here come the worms. Back them in. There's a fact that you hadn't expected to learn today.
I did learn they went fully vegan for Billie Eilish's shows last year. Like they're doing a lot of different stuff, which is one of my things. That my wife's vegan and I'm not, but I've started having vegan burgers or plant burgers whenever I see them now, because, and this is maybe not the branding they want, but there is greasy and unhealthy feeling as real burgers now, which is what I kind of missed, you know, when I was trying not to eat as much meat. And now plant burgers, now they're kind of, to me, so that the O2 have been doing all these little things, and I think they're providing a lot of case studies that everyone else can learn from. So I think it's really good.
Next, not a live venue, but some buildings which have ended up by proxy almost being a live venue. The cinema chain AMC Theatres has seen a huge jump in its revenues recently, and the CEO has said that a lot of this is down to showing the Taylor Swift and Beyonce concert films.
Yeah, the unexpected saviors of cinema, because yeah. I think, and we talk.
I just can't imagine watching a gig in a cinema. Have you ever watched a gig in a cinema?
Do you know? No, I haven't. But my niece is a massive Swiftie, and she went with my sister-in-law to see the Taylor Swift tour.
Oh, right.
Apparently it was brilliant, because it was a cinema full of Swifties all chatting to each other, excited about seeing it. Because of course Taylor Swift tickets are as rare as hen's teeth. Like,
yeah.
I mean, again, my entire family was signed up to try and get tickets for my niece, and we all didn't get through. And apparently it's brilliant. Like, they're all singing and dancing. It was like those kind of, you know, they get the Sound of Music sing-alongs and everyone dresses up for them. It's kind of that for a young fan base. So apparently good. But I mean, a lot of the bands I like aren't big enough to get everyone to go to the cinema, unfortunately.
No. There are some small screens down at the Brixton Ritzy. We might be able to fill those out.
I went to the premiere. This is a tangent. I went to the premiere of the Darknesses documentary last year in Cambridge, and that was nice. Like, a whole room full of people who like the Darkness enough to go and see the documentary about them. It's like a community thing. But yeah, so I mean, Taylor Swift did this film. Beyonce did a film. Taylor Swift is actually the biggest documentary / concert film in history. I think it did like $261 million of ticket sales around the world last year. And yeah, this company AMC, who are one of the big cinema chains amongst other things, I think that they made $1.1 billion in the fourth quarter of last year. And that was up 11.5% year on year. And yeah, like you say, the CEO said, and he said these words, literally all of that increase was due to Taylor Swift and Beyonce. Like, everything else was kind of flat. So yeah, it's kind of, and he was saying that apparently the phone's been ringing off the hook from the music industry, who've seen what they did and said, right, we'd like a bit of that. We're going to film our concert tour. And the other thing with Taylor Swift is her documentary is now, it was on Amazon Prime Video for a while. Now I think it's on something else, Disney Plus. So it's kind of got this second life. So she's doing really well from a cinema showing of a concert followed by streaming video of it. So this is kind of a new model for, I mean, it's really for superstars, I think. Like, but the other thing is those people, like Taylor Swift has been doing this massive tour, but there's a lot of places she hasn't gone to. You know, you can't visit every country. So I think there's talk about that as well, like fans in countries where you don't often get those big stadium gigs, you can now go with other fans to a venue and watch it.
Mm-hmm. And this is a slight shift away from what we were being told would be the future, which was bands doing it for themselves. I mean, is it more valuable to the artists to have their film shown in a cinema rather than, say, streaming it via their own website? I guess in a way it's easier because you don't have to put any investment into, you know, hosting the film and all the sign up fees and everything. It's basically just shown in a cinema. But that at one point was going to be the future of gigs for people who couldn't afford the ticket or couldn't get the ticket, was you could sit at home and watch it on your laptop.
Yeah, and that's still happening. But yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, filming a gig for a cinema, it's expensive. You need like lots of cameras. You need good surround sound. You need like, it's got to be a cinematic production.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I remember those lives. I remember like, I watched the Dua Lipa one. That was really good. I remember watching the Gorillaz one. Did you see that one during lockdown when Gorillaz did a live stream? Oh, by the end, they had all the guest artists who kind of came and joined them. And at the end, they're all on the stage together dancing in this kind of moment of abandon. Like, you could tell they'd been struggling with lockdown too. And I was at home nearly crying at that, because it was such an emotional moment to think we're all stuck in, but this band are performing and music is. So yeah, I mean, I thought that would be the future. But then as soon as lockdown stopped, everyone's like, no, we need to get back on the road again. And I think it's difficult really to, I think if you're going to do a live stream now, people expect production values and it has to be a proper thing. You could stick a camera at your gig and film it, but it seems to have kind of just stalled a bit.
Again, it comes back to your superstars who've got the budget. If you've got the budget, you can make a really decent fist of it. If you haven't, if you are filming your rehearsal. Well, I mean, having said that, I mean, you know, if there were bands, I thought this would happen at one point, that rather than A&R people running around the country, zipping up and down the motorway, looking at new artists, or having to go to their gigs, they'd just sit in London and wait for a rehearsal stream, and you could just watch the bands from the comfort of your very fancy desk in your nice office.
It's true. I mean, I do want to say that the one thing that has stayed with me from the AMC results isn't really the concert films. It's, you know, everyone always says, like, cinemas make all their money from popcorn, and that's like a an assumption. But in their results, they break out admissions and food and beverage. So there's actually a line in the financials that tells you exactly how much money. And AMC made $2.7 billion from admissions, ticket sales, and $1.7 billion from food and beverage. And then some other stuff. So I've got an answer to it. Like, how much do cinemas make from popcorn? It's about a third, 34.7% of their money came from. So all those Swifties and Beehive members who went to see the films, if they bought popcorn, they were also generating bottom line profits.
I can't believe how food based this episode has become, and leads us quite nicely to this, which is a proper and finally story to close on. And finally, a thrash metal band in America has released its latest single as A Slice of Pizza.
They have, which is, I mean, we don't need to talk about it, do we? That's kind of that's the story. But yeah, they're called Belushi Speedball, which is a reference that probably is best not to kind of look into too deeply. And they were formed in 2013. And I've been watching some of their live shows on YouTube. It looks a lot of fun, although you wouldn't be in the middle of their mosh pit. It looks very, very sparky. And they've got a song called We Aren't Thrashers, We Are Hipster Posers, which I really like the cut of their jib. You know, that's, but they, yeah, their favorite song is called My Favorite. The latest song is called My Favorite Color is Pizza. And it's on their Bandcamp store as a physical piece of pizza. So it's got a slice of pizza encased in resin, so it doesn't kind of go rotten.
Right.
And you can order it Detroit or New York style, which pizza fans will probably know what the difference is. And it costs $75, which even makes Domino's look cheap. So, but they're not signed to Domino, sadly.
What's the markup? I wonder how much they're making out of that. Probably more than you'd make out of your average piece of vinyl. There's some cash in that, maybe. Well done to them. And can I just utter the phrase once uttered by Bono, only in America. And that's is where we'll leave it for this week. Only in America. Just before we go this week, can we just, we'd just like to say thank you very much to everyone who sent us some encouraging messages of support via our email and left us messages on the socials. Because I think when we started this a month ago, obviously we hoped you'd like it. We hoped people would like it and find it informative. But we were, I think in the words of Bruce Springsteen, dancing in the dark. Wouldn't you say, Stuart?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's getting beyond, it's when it gets beyond your friends and family telling you it's great to people who don't know you at all and have no reason to tell you. That's when I took it seriously.
hang on a second. Your friends and family have told you it's great. Hang on, where come on, where's family Lamo with, you know, some cheery support in the background? Thank you. But anyway, thank you very much, everyone who's been in touch. And thanks to producer Guy for making this happen. If you have enjoyed this episode and you haven't already, please do subscribe to the show in your podcast app. And if you get a moment, give us a review and a rating and tell your friends. We're here every week. And if you have a question which you'd like us to answer on the show, or, of course, as I mentioned earlier, any specific questions for our Spotify representative, email us at this address, Stuart.
theprice of music podcast@gmail.com. And that's the first time I had to do that without looking it up in a panic in my email when you asked me.
See, we're getting there. Slowly but surely, with all this practice, we're getting somewhere. Thank you very much, everybody. Take care of yourselves. Ta-ra.